Brussels on lockdown for a third day. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Brussels remains on edge amid warnings of an imminent threat. Our reporter there says the lockdown reminds her of Boston after the marathon bombings.
The eeriness, the quietness, the uncertainty, the debates about whether this is overkill or whether it's a really good thing. It's so uncannily reminiscent of Boston.
Plus, how ISIS spends its money.
If your vision of the future is to usher in an apocalypse, you don't need to invest in long-term infrastructure.
And we remember the life and politics of Germany's Helmut Schmidt.
His views stayed the same, pragmatic, realist kind of politics. What changed is Germany changed around him.
That's all coming up today on The World. Lockdown again. That's what you'd be dealing with today in Belgium, where authorities have shut down the capital, Brussels, for a third day in a row. Schools, malls, and subways are all closed, and we hear they will stay closed until Wednesday. Officials have warned that there's a serious and imminent threat of a terrorist attack like the ones in Paris 10 days ago. Several of the Paris gunmen lived in Belgium, and the hunt for one of them is still on. My colleague Jeb Sharp is in Brussels. Usually she's based here in Boston, where, of course, we had our own lockdown following the Boston Marathon bombings in 2013. And Jeb says what she's experiencing in Brussels is familiar.
Definitely. As soon as the language of lockdown and the U.S. Embassy put out a thing saying, please shelter in place, American citizens, that language alone just took me right back to that day in April of 2013 when all of us were asked to stay inside for an entire Friday. And in a funny way, I had the same feeling because I had to decide whether to venture out as a reporter, and I did in the end. And the same feeling of not quite having enough information, knowing there's a manhunt on, knowing there might be a threat, but sort of waiting for officialdom to pronounce things and being told what to do, but really not having a lot to go on. And so just the eeriness, the quietness, the uncertainty, the debates about whether this is overkill or whether it's a really good thing, it's so uncannily reminiscent.
When Jeb did venture out yesterday, she came across this next story. She happened to walk past a Syrian bakery in Brussels and went inside.
The shop is like something out of a storybook. Dusk is falling, but the display cases in the window gleam with color. Plates of heaping candies and sweetmeats beckon. And the owner, Imad Kakutli, is only too happy to show off his wares.
And here we have the nut finger. It tastes very well, yeah. Here we have mabruma with a kind of pistachio, because Aleppo is famous for pistachio. And here we have mamoul walnut. This is homemade. Most of this is homemade, we make it.
It looks so good.
Kakutli has an easy way with his customers, chatting, joking, taking pictures of people for his Facebook page.
Where are you from?
And we're from the Netherlands.
Netherlands?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to give you some like.
Kakutli tells me he's had the shop for 3 years. It used to be called Mediterranean Sweets, but 3 months ago he decided to change it to The Light of Damascus, Patisserie Syrienne, or Syrian Bakery.
Because I miss my country, that's why I changed the name.
But now he's not so sure. In the last week since the Paris attacks, business has plummeted. He says he watches people look up at the sign that says Syria and then move on. Before this week, they used to come streaming in.
See, the customer were like looking at the name and they were wondering and they keep going. That's why I was like thinking, change the name, I just want to call it something like French, La Maison de Delise. Yeah, I think it's better for me and for the people.
So he called a painter and asked him to change the sign from Syrian Patisserie to House of Delights.
One friend, he said, just put like something French for people to feel comfortable in your shop. And this is true.
And will they come on Monday?
I hope so. He is Arabic. I don't know if he come on Monday or Thursday.
Kakutli is a joker, but it masks a deep sadness. He left Syria as a young man and settled in Germany, and later worked in the U.S. But in 2008, he decided to go back to his homeland and start a restaurant. Then in 2011, the Arab Spring began. Syria erupted. He had no faith in the regime changing its ways, so he left again.
I don't know what to tell you. I don't watch the news. I don't like watching news. I don't like watch people kill, and I'm not interested anymore about it because I feel sad from inside.
Kakutli is almost 50 now. He keeps having to start over. He's sad about the war, and he's sad about the Paris attacks. And he's worried what people think about Syrians because of ISIS and because of the Syrian passport that was found with the Paris attackers.
Europe, they were very helpful for our people when they come here. And I really appreciate it for Europe and everybody help Syrian people when they enter the country. We don't have to hurt these people. We have to respect with a huge smile, not big smile. This is my opinion.
But you're worried that Brussels people and tourists see Syria and think ISIS.
Maybe.
And
because
so
I have to think about it. Like, they don't understand what's going on. What do you think if we change the name?
Well, it makes me terribly sad, but I understand.
Me too.
We linger a while and sample his Syrian sweets. Kakutli makes a mean Belgian waffle, too, so we have some of those as well, slathered with chocolate and strong, thick Turkish coffee. I can't think of anywhere I'd rather be in this moment. His shop is warm and bright and colorful. Outside, there's a cold rain falling and a scary security alert, and lots of soldiers with guns. For the World, I'm Jeb Sharp, Brussels.
Here's a question I found myself asking these last few days. Why Belgium? The World's Clark Boyd has lived and worked in Brussels. So what is going on in Belgium, Clark? Why does it seem so hard for authorities there to tackle Islamic radicalization?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Marco, because Belgium is a country that itself is split between sort of the Flemish north, the Dutch-speaking north, and the French-speaking south. And because of that, there's a lot of bureaucracy that builds up around that, a lot of division over money, taxes, language, everything. I mean, the country often talks about tearing itself apart and becoming two separate nations. You know, 3 days before the attacks in Paris, the interior minister was giving a speech, and he basically said one of the reasons that this country has such a hard time with these kinds of extremists is its own fractured nature. And I think because of that, the buildup of that bureaucracy and the infighting, that this kind of thing has kind of grown and festered in the midst of that.
I can see how a linguistic divide would lead to all sorts of bureaucratic messes in a small country like this. But how does it lead to security problems?
Just the fact that a lot of the police working on both sides of the divisions, a lot of the officials working on both sides of that linguistic division don't actually ever talk to each other or share information. Take a place like Brussels, for example. This is the capital not just of Belgium. This is the capital of Europe. This is the seat of the European Union. Within that, you've got, you know, roughly 1 million people. There are 19 different municipalities, which means 19 different mayors. And there are 6 different police forces responsible for the various parts of the city. Compare that to New York. New York has 8 million people. They have 1 police force.
For all 5 boroughs.
For all 5 boroughs.
People. Yeah. It seems like it's a really complex proposition to say just have one language and just...
Impossible to say that in Belgium.
Yeah. So what about just having 1 police force for Brussels? Why can't that be suggested?
Marco, having lived there, I have to say I think inertia plays a huge role. This is the way we've always done it. We've always been happy with the fact that we have a police force that speaks our language, whether you're on one side or the other. And I think people are just very reluctant to change there. I mean, this is a country, when I first moved there, went without a federal government for more than 500 days. And was there any sort of outward sign of that going on? No. Trash still got picked up. Mail still got delivered. People's pensions were secure. And I was thinking to myself, wow, 500 days without a federal government. And I actually started asking people, so is Belgium the most successful failed state in the world? And I would get laughs and people would say, yeah, maybe you could call it that. But with what we're seeing now, it's stuff that you need coordination across all these various levels and languages and divides to actually get something done.
And the lack of coordination, we're kind of pinning on bureaucracy and infighting in Belgium's government. Are there other reasons, though, why maybe Belgium is attractive to extremists?
Yeah, I think it's unfair to pin it all on their bureaucracy, and it's unfair to pin it all on the Belgian state. Belgium is incredibly centrally located in Europe. You can get to Paris, London, Amsterdam all within 2 hours. That's one reason. The other reason is it has some of the lax gun laws in all of Europe. So it allows weapons to come into the country a lot easier.
I'm just wondering, are you hearing from any of your old contacts in Belgium, Clark, that recent events will prompt any change to this system in Belgium?
So, Marco, people that I'm in contact with are just shocked and saddened beyond belief at this. And, you know, I'm looking at those empty streets there in Brussels, metro closed, schools closed, people not gathering, people not going out and having a beer. And it's shocking. It's shocking to me. I never thought that I would see that kind of situation in Brussels. It will be interesting to see whether that new kind of fear, I think, for Belgians, coupled with the fact that there's so much attention now on Molenbeek, not just in Belgium, but from around the world, they're going to have a lot of pressure to change things. So maybe it actually will help them overcome this inertia to actually change the way the state is structured to more effectively deal with these kind of threats.
The World's Clark Boyd, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Last Friday, 1 week after the Paris attacks, the West African nation of Mali lived through its own hostage crisis. Gunmen stormed the Radisson Blue Hotel in the capital Bamako, killing at least 19 people. Today, though, the streets of Bamako were busy again.
The Malian people know what it is to live under that kind of threat, the jihadi threat.
That's my BBC colleague Thomas Fessy in Bamako.
Mali has been living on a sort of state of vigilance, if you will, for at least the last 3 years. Remember in 2012 when jihadi groups took over the northern region of Mali, nearly two-thirds of the country, and that sparked, prompted the French to intervene in January 2013. And so I can't really tell that security has been really stepped up in town, apart from perhaps more security around the main hotels where foreign guests are staying.
We now know that more than 20 people were killed on Friday, plus the two gunmen. What is the latest on the investigation into who staged this attack at the Radisson Blu on Friday and what their motives were? I mean, do we know for sure that there were only two gunmen?
Although we do know that the two attackers you were talking about were killed, we don't know whether they operated alone. Two jihadi groups linked to Al-Qaeda are saying that they actually carried out the attack together, and they are saying that only two attackers were involved, and they suggest that they were actually Malians. But there's another claim that emerged today, that of a more recent jihadi group in Mali that only emerged in central Mali a few months ago. And they are saying that five attackers were involved, which would suggest that three other suspects are indeed on the run. But it is obviously possible that all these groups are using all the reports that are out for propaganda purposes, and that they are taking advantage of the confusion for their own sakes.
Thomas, it seemed pretty conclusive on Friday that there was no connection between the attacks in Bamako and those in Paris a week earlier. Today, any sense that they may or may not be related?
You need to remember that Mali has been threatened by jihadi groups for at least the last 3 years, and that this kind of attack has happened, maybe not on that scale, but for example, jihadi groups struck in the capital back in March. Five people were shot dead at the terrace of a restaurant on a Saturday night. And the French forces, together with UN peacekeepers and the Malian forces, are still struggling to stem the violence in northern Mali. They're still trying to flush them out, all these remaining pockets of jihadi groups operating in northern Mali. So this is not a new situation here. And the fact that you have so many claims from different jihadi groups also show that the local game of jihadi groups here is very complex, and that you even have rival jihadi groups competing over whoever does an attack here.
My colleague with the BBC, Thomas Fessy, speaking with me from the Malian capital, Bamako. Thanks very much for your time today, Thomas.
Thank you.
Later here on The World, one of the Paris attackers is thought to have carried a fake Syrian passport. We'll tell you about the huge black market right now for fake Syrian documents and about who's trying to get them. That's coming up later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Let's head down to the southern tip of the Americas, to Argentina, where there was a runoff election yesterday to decide on a new president. Argentines elected the business-friendly opposition candidate, Mauricio Macri. Macri has promised, when he takes over in a couple of weeks, to revitalize Argentina's rather sagging economy. My BBC colleague Veronica Smink joins me from Buenos Aires. So incumbent President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner could not run due to term limits, but the candidate she had endorsed was beaten. So does that mean between Macri's victory and the loss by the Fernandez-approved Daniel Scioli that this is a huge change for Argentina?
It's a historic change, not only because Macri has won, but also because his political party, Cambiemos, also won the province of Buenos Aires, the most populated province in Argentina, and the city of Buenos Aires. This is something unprecedented.
How's this political sea change going to affect things for ordinary Argentines on the street?
Well, this is a complete difference for Argentines because this is the first time that a party that was created in 2003, so in the 21st century, is going to rule the country. So even though there is worry about the economic situation and how Macri will handle it, I think the sense on the street is that there is a hope that whatever happens, it will be something different to what was happening before. I feel a lot of hope. Obviously, you know, the supporters of the Kirchnerista government are obviously not happy with this change. They are warning, as did Scioli, the candidate, that, you know, there is an impending doom, economic doom coming up. So again, there is anxiety about what's going to happen, but a lot of hope.
Basically, what are the economic problems facing the country? And when President-elect Macri says economic reform is his top priority, what's he going to do?
Well, the economy has basically been paralyzed for the past 4 years due to many reasons, some of them external and some of them to do with the economic policies that the Kirchnerista government has taken. But basically, Argentina has a massive inflation problem above 25%. This has been going on for years. The central bank reserves are extremely low. There has been almost no jobs created in the private sector in the past 4 years. And many of the local economies, especially in rural areas, are completely paralyzed. And so Macri will have to find a way out of this situation without causing, you know, a massive disruption, without sending a lot of Argentines into poverty, which is the main preoccupation, you know, is that he will devalue the peso and a lot of people will suffer.
Any change on the horizon for Argentine-U.S. relations from this victory?
Yes, one would assume that either candidates who had won would have closer relationships, closer ties to the U.S., which was something, you know, traditionally happening in Argentine foreign policy, which changed with the Kirchner government. So for the past 12 years, the relationships have been tense, and this is definitely expected to change.
What does that actually feel like in the streets? Does it feel like a new day in Buenos Aires?
Yes, absolutely. I think a lot of people, when the first round of elections happened on the 21st of October, that's when the real surprise hit. None of the exit pollsters had identified the possibility that Macri could do well. He was only 3 points below Scioli in the first round. And I think that brought a lot of hope to many people who had no expectations that a big change like that could happen. So when Macri was elected, and by a very small margin as well, by less than 3 points last night, definitely the sense of a lot of people in Argentina was that we can't believe that this is happening. A lot of people still say, I still can't believe that this has happened.
My BBC colleague, Veronica Smink. Thanks a lot, Veronica.
Always a pleasure.
Former German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt was buried today in his hometown of Hamburg. He died last week at the age of 96. Over the course of his life, Helmut Schmidt became known as a kind of curmudgeon and proud of it. In his later years, though, the retired politician became something of a hip icon for young Germans. That's what Cameron Abadi told me. He's senior editor at Foreign Policy magazine.
Helmut himself stayed the same throughout his life. His views stayed the same. Were always that sort of curmudgeonly, pragmatic, realist kind of politics. Germany changed around him. You know, he was chancellor and in politics in the 60s and 70s, the heyday of sort of idealism as young people were kind of coming to the fore, pushing for sort of more idealistic policies. And when he left office, and especially in the last couple of decades, Germany has sort of become more pragmatic place, and especially in the last kind of few years with the euro crisis, young people have been looking around for a more authoritative figure. And Helmut Schmidt, again, the uber realist, was there waiting for them.
So give us a bit of his story, Cameron. I know Helmut Schmidt's paternal grandfather was actually Jewish, and Schmidt hid that throughout his service during the war.
That's right. I mean, his lifetime spanned essentially the entire 20th century of German history. It's also part of what makes him so fascinating, I think, for younger people. He was born before World War II, ended up fighting in that war. And as you point out, he had to hide this personal information about himself. He fought in the army, even though he found the regime that he was fighting for repellent, but he felt compelled to defend the country. After the war, he was the generation that had to sort of pick up the country and rebuild. And so he was heavily involved in that. And during the Cold War, was one of the leading politicians, and then became chancellor in the 70s.
Was there from 74 through 82, but I gather kind of struggled to hang on to the support of his own Social Democrats. Why?
There was one particular issue. He felt it was necessary for Germany to have nuclear weapons stationed on German soil to defend the country against the Soviet Union. The people around him basically felt that was risky and not worth it and wanted a more idealistic foreign policy. And basically, his support collapsed. It really came down to the nuclear weapons issue.
As you say, it wasn't so much Helmut Schmidt who changed, but rather Germany that changed. How much of the history that Helmut Schmidt was part of, how much has that played into why he died last week, very popular with Germans in their 30s and 20s?
I think one aspect of it is actually also just a matter of style. I mean, he also had a throwback kind of style. He smoked cigarettes wherever he was. He was a chain smoker. And then I think in an era now where everyone...
Even into his 90s, right?
Even into his 90s. I think he even got to the age where the doctors just told him not to quit because that was going to even be more of a health risk than continuing. But beyond the stylistic question, there is, I think, this point about his pragmatic policies, about being cautious in the world, about being realistic about one's possibilities. And I think, again, yeah, right now in this era of crisis in Germany and crisis in Europe, people realize, yeah, I think someone with experience, someone who's seen devastation, someone who's been through so many crises, whether it was World War II or terrorism in the 1970s, this is, again, a moment of crisis and terrorism. And I think young people realized that they had someone with experience.
You met Helmut Schmidt a few years ago, Cameron. Already he was well into his 90s. What struck you about him?
He was a man who incorporated all of this history into his person. He didn't hide the fact that he believed he knew answers and he knew how the world worked. He was very upfront about that. That might come across as arrogant, but I think someone in his 90s who's actually been involved in events throughout his life actually has earned that kind of arrogance. So that was kind of what I felt sitting down with him.
And in that hour you had with him one-on-one, how many cigarettes did he smoke?
I think he got up to 8. That was my tally. He was chain-smoking till the end.
Cameron Abadi, senior editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Canada is planning to resettle thousands of Syrian refugees in the next few weeks, and a lot of ordinary Canadians want to help.
The money's been coming in very rapidly. We've also had a lot of concrete offers of help and sofa beds, old dinette sets, mattresses.
That story's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The Paris attacks 10 days ago began almost simultaneously. In the hours that followed, hundreds of people were killed and were injured. And for some, the nightmare lasted even longer, because days after the attacks, a lot of other people were still searching for their missing loved ones. Two high school friends thought they could help. And that's where reporter Daniel Estrin's story begins.
A day after the attacks, Steve Puget started a Facebook page. He called it Recherche Paris, Search Paris. He wrote this post: "If you're looking for someone who was in Paris last night, send a description and the place where that person was." When he woke up the next morning, the page had about 400 likes, and people started writing messages asking for help finding their loved ones. But Steve, who's 18, was in no real position to go out and find them, because he does not live in Paris. He lives 250 miles south, in the middle of the country, in the town of Les. Population, about 1,000. To get there, my translator and I took a fast train from Paris. You zip past rolling green farmland, and an hour and a half later, you're in the small city of Mâcon.
Mesdames, messieurs, dans quelques instants, notre TGV desservira la gare de Mâcon.
Then it's a 15-minute drive to Les.
The cows also. There are cows all over the place, all around us.
Steve meets us in the parking lot of the Super U supermarket. He's wearing jeans rolled up at the cuffs, He has the faint trace of a teenage mustache. It was a 5-minute walk to his house. We walked into his bedroom, and he closed the door. The posters and bedspread in his bedroom have a New York City taxi theme. I think his mom may have made him make the bed before we came. She knocked on his door.
Oui?
Bonjour, la maman.
Is that embarrassing?
C'est l'habitude, elle fait tout le monde.
I'm used to it. She does it all the time.
I told Steve I don't understand how an 18-year-old decides that he can help find the missing hundreds of miles from where the attacks took place.
Bah, c'est pas par rapport à ça. C'est surtout parce que c'est pas Paris qui a été touché, c'est la France.
It's not about Paris, it's about France. It's not just Paris being attacked, it's the whole France. So to him, it's not about being far away or something. It's the same country.
And also, for him, it's like, what can't be done on Facebook? Many of the dead and injured hadn't been identified for days. Relatives and friends didn't know if they were dead or alive, or which hospital they might be in. So Steve and his high school buddy, Nicolas, fielded hundreds of Facebook messages.
So the first message we received was on a Sunday morning, and it's a woman called Carole who sends a picture of her friend, and she says, I'm looking for my friend Cédric, who was at the Bataclan. People from the police took him away. He was hurt at the face. Here is his picture. Please help me.
Steve shared it on his Facebook page, and others shared the post. Meanwhile, Nicolas called a bunch of hospitals in Paris. He had a list of names of missing. The hospitals were totally overwhelmed. No one on the other end of the line was being helpful. But Steve and Nicolas kept getting Facebook messages. So they started posting names and photos of the missing, and hundreds of people started sharing the Facebook posts, spreading the word. Sometimes someone would write in to say, hey, that's my friend, and she's alive. And Steve and Nicolas would write back to the person to share the good news. Sometimes someone would post the news of a person's death from a news site. That's how the news came in that Cédric, the guy who Carole was looking for, had died.
Non, toutes les histoires qu'on a faites, on avait l'impression vraiment d'être...
Every story was moving and we felt like we were part of the families and we were part of their families, so it was always difficult, but yeah.
Steve wasn't getting the information himself, but he was often the one who'd break the sad news to whoever had written in. No one prepared Steve to do this. He's just a senior in high school. He runs a few video game forums on the internet. He's in a technical track at school, studying to be an electrician. He's a teenager of few words. When it was bad news he had to share, he would type out the same line to everybody.
Toutes mes condoléances à vous et à sa famille.
Our condolences to you and his family.
All the missing have now been accounted for, except for one. One young guy wrote a note online saying he was looking for a young girl who stalled him from taking a bus to an area that was attacked. He felt he owed her his life. I like you, the guy wrote. It was the kind of missed connection post you'd find on Craigslist. Steve and Nicolas shared the note on their Facebook page. The guy is still looking for the girl. Steve's mom, by the way, told me she's really proud of her son for what he's done. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Les, France.
French investigators are still trying to identify some of the men who attacked Paris on November 13th. That includes two of the suicide bombers now thought to have entered Europe through Greece. A Syrian passport was found near one of the bodies. The passport was a fake, and its discovery raised concerns, both in Europe and here in the U.S., about ISIS extremists posing as Syrian refugees. But it also highlighted a separate problem, a thriving black market in fake Syrian passports. The documents are in very high demand as the number of refugees trying to leave Syria keeps rising. That's according to Chris Doyle. He's with the Council for Arab-British Understanding in London.
Well, the trade is huge because there's a huge demand, firstly from Syrian refugees desperate to get out of Syria, largely through Turkey and Lebanon, into Europe, where they hope they can rebuild their lives after the dreadful conflict in Syria. But also, there are others who wish to take advantage of this. There are those who may wish to take advantage of them for criminal reasons, for reasons of committing acts of terrorism. There are also those who may not actually be Syrians, but have calculated that actually with a Syrian passport, they stand a better chance of getting into Europe. Now, the problem is that there are all sorts of parties who are only too happy to encourage this trade in forged documents, whether it's passports, birth certificates, even fake degrees, which are then subsequently used perhaps to get jobs in Europe or elsewhere. These would include criminals, but also the Syrian regime, for example, who are happy to make some money out of this, and also to see opponents leaving the country, getting essentially off their books. That means one less person to deal with. So it's a very difficult industry to stop.
How easy is it to get a fake Syrian passport, and how much do they cost?
You hear all sorts of different prices. For a very low-quality one, you may pay something in the region of $200 to $250. To a better-level quality one, maybe $2,000 to $3,000. So you get all sorts, and some of them can be picked up. The trouble is, with the huge numbers that are going across via Turkey into Greece, in other countries in Europe, I don't believe that the authorities there are really on top of things to be able to really monitor all of this, identify which passports are fake, which are not.
There are also reports that ISIS has taken over a passport office in Syria, and that's where a lot of these passports are coming from. How much do we know about that?
There are sketchy stories about this. One is that they produce their own, which isn't, of course, any use in that it's not accepted by any other countries, but symbolic value. There's some queries over that. But certainly ISIS is more than capable of using all sorts of criminal means to earn money. And it encourages its supporters to commit criminal acts to finance their particular activities, including even travel to Syria. So they certainly, as other terrorist groups have done before them, are getting involved with, you know, forgery rackets. They're getting involved with drugs rackets. There is a war economy going on in Syria that has inverted normal economic activity. Forgeries and criminality are one huge part of that.
Even the cheapest of these fake passports, how easy is it to tell they're fake?
If you are a seasoned customs official, you can tell the cheap ones if you know what you're doing. But I fear that not all of them do. There have been passports that turned up that haven't been numbered properly, that don't even look quite right. At the top end, the expensive ones are very, very difficult to tell because they've often been produced actually by the regime for a large sum of money, people working for them who are making money on the side.
Do you know of any refugees who have been turned away because it was seen that they had fake passports?
I don't know any personally, but I've heard of this. Certainly there have been reports of this. There have been reports even where the customs officials in Europe have even been quite sympathetic. They can see that these people may be desperate. Remember, some of these people have had to flee because their home has been blown up. They haven't had access to their documents. They've lost all their identity papers. So they really have nothing to go on. They are forced to try to use all these sorts of measures.
Well, yeah, I mean, your point is really apt that fake passports are really just a function of desperation. A lot of Jews had to forge their documents to get out of Europe.
It's a function of desperation, and the appalling thing is that there are also people who are willing to exploit that for their own nefarious, evil means.
Chris Doyle with the Council for Arab-British Understanding. Thank you.
Thank you.
Another question that's getting a lot of attention in the aftermath of the Paris attacks, how does ISIS pay for all its fighters and far-flung activities? The so-called Islamic State has income in the millions of dollars, and it's going to be difficult for the U.S. or anyone to do anything about it. That's what Cam Simpson found out when he investigated the financial side of ISIS. I reached him in the newsroom of Bloomberg Businessweek in London.
A lot of their money, as we know, and as we've known for quite some time, comes from oil. The territories that they have across Iraq and Syria, as you know, are pretty oil-rich territories. And, you know, they've seized all of the oil. They control all of the oil. Oil is not just really the lifeblood of the organization, but it's also the lifeblood of the people who live in the territory that they very brutally control. So it's quite hard to cut it off, you know, without cutting off the population, without cutting off the lifeblood of the people.
So you say this is the lifeblood of the local people, the oil, but is ISIS really cutting in the locals on the profits from this oil?
Oh, absolutely. ISIS makes its money at the extraction point, you know, the wellhead or whatever you want to call it. Sometimes it's just a hose pipe buried in the sand. They just give crude to the buyers, you know, trucks, to guys with jerry cans, you name it. I mean, it's traitors, it's cross-border, it's internal. I mean, even, you know, the rebel groups that are fighting ISIS, the other rebel groups, are buying their oil from ISIS.
So how hard would it be to stop the transactions?
I mean, it's virtually impossible. I mean, you can go after the tanker trucks, and we started doing that after the Paris attacks. But again, there, you know, those are civilians, and I'm not sure what kind of an appetite we have for killing that many civilians. And I'm not sure what kind of an appetite we have for destroying, you know, the lifeblood of these communities. You can't really starve this organization without starving the people who live under its power.
Talk to us a little bit about the sale of looted antiquities. How much money are they getting from that?
You know, that's probably the one disputed thing. I think, you know, generally speaking, the intelligence estimates sort of group together antiquities looting with kidnapping ransoms. And you're looking at, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year.
Now, Saudi Arabians have funded extremism in the past. Is there any connection between the kingdom and ISIS?
You know, I think there was some documented individual Saudi support and some documented individual support from Kuwait for these guys before last year, you know, but they don't rely on foreign funding at all. I mean, it's a minimal amount. You know, the best estimates that I've seen are like up to $5 million. When you look at everything else we're talking about, like up to $1 billion in seized cash from banks alone, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars from the taxes, the antiquities, the kidnapping ransoms, $500 million in oil, you know, a few million bucks from some religious supporters in Gulf states is pretty meaningless.
So if we can employ the old saw of follow the money, what will it take to stop the ISIS flow of money?
Marco, again, there's no flow, right? I mean, it's all internal. If there was a way to stop it externally, if it was a flow, I think we would probably be doing it. One thing that is happening is it seems like now the airstrikes are more directed at the crude oil infrastructure on the ground, and that's probably going to make some difference, at least for a while. How much of a difference it's going to make, I don't know. How much of a stomach we're going to have to take on the civilian casualties that will happen if we really, really, really seriously go after that oil infrastructure, I don't know. And even if we do that, again, there's just so much money to pay their fighters. And that's really the main thing that they need the money for. If your vision of the future is to usher in an apocalypse, you don't need to invest in long-term infrastructure. I mean, you know, we call them a state, but they're not really a state, and they don't invest or care about their people or invest in them the way that, you know, we think of here in the West.
Cam Simpson with Bloomberg Businessweek joining us from their London newsroom. Thanks so much for your time.
It's my pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
Here's a story we've got coming up in just a couple of minutes. Jean-Christophe Bisselard is a hospital chaplain in Paris, and he was on call the night of the terrorist attacks.
What really struck me a lot was, I guess, you know, the anxiety, the fear as well, is quite distressing, to say the least.
And he should know he was in New York on 9/11, helping others deal with tragedy that's ahead on the world. I'm Marco Werman with The World. A lot of presidential candidates, governors, and members of Congress may not like it, but the U.S. remains committed to admitting 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next year. Canada, on the other hand, is preparing to welcome 25,000 refugees in the next 6 weeks. Resettling refugees takes a lot of time and money, helping new arrivals find places to live, work, and go to school. Canada has a unique system for that. Ordinary citizens can volunteer to share the load, and many are doing so right now. The World's Jason Margolis has this profile of one of the volunteers.
Meet Jennifer Nagel, philosophy professor at the University of Toronto.
So I'm an epistemologist. I work in the theory of knowledge.
2 months ago, like billions across the globe, Nagel was moved by the photo of a 3-year-old Syrian boy washed up on a beach in Turkey. So she hatched an idea.
I put up a Facebook post asking if there was anybody in my network who might be interested in sponsoring refugees, bringing them over. I'd heard about the private sponsorship of refugees program.
Quickly, 15 friends and friends of friends step forward.
And this right here is our request for refugee profile form. It's a very simple 2-page form that any community group can fill out and just mail off to the government.
The government did background checks on Nagel's group. Everything looked okay, so the Canadian government is now allowing the group to sponsor a Syrian family of six, a widow and five children living in a refugee camp in Lebanon. The government also did a comprehensive security screening on the family, looking into their past history. Nagel says she's not worried about potentially letting in bad guys. Her Syrian family has been identified as urgently needing protection. Canada began encouraging small groups to sponsor refugees back in 1979. Since then, volunteers in Canada have helped resettle more than 225,000 refugees from across the globe. Nagel's group is trying to raise the required $33,000 to help support their Syrian family during their first year here. To do that, Nagel started a Facebook page and an online donation site.
The money's been coming in very rapidly. We've also had a lot of concrete offers of help, sofa beds, old dinette sets, mattresses.
Raising funds and materials, that's the easy part.
You have to develop a settlement plan and submit that along with your application to sponsor the family. You've really got to cover all the practical needs that the family's going to have when they arrive in the country. So you've got to make sure that the children will be enrolled in school, the adults will be enrolled in English lessons. You promise to support them in looking for employment. You find them a doctor, find them a dentist, and we're going to sign up the 8-year-old kid in soccer lessons.
Nagel's group is on the hook for a year. After that, refugees are expected to be self-sufficient. Privately sponsoring a refugee is complex, but the Canadian government offers training and support and provides some funding. Local resettlement agencies also lend a hand. Still, Nagel says they'll try to do as much as they can on their own.
We are probably going to be dividing ourselves into different task areas. So I can certainly see myself going grocery shopping with this family every weekend. I'd like to be involved with the kids. There's three teenage daughters. I have two sons but no daughters, so this could be kind of fun for me. But we'll see. It depends on the family as well, and it depends on how much contact they want with us. We want to respect their privacy. You know, we want to be there for them, but we don't want to be all over them.
Studies have shown that private sponsorships can build stronger community ties between Canadians and incoming refugees. Nagel expects her family to arrive sometime before Christmas. By the way, they don't speak English, and she doesn't know what they look like. She says they're going to make a sign in Arabic and hold it up at the airport. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Toronto.
Finally today, it's been 10 days since the terrorist attacks in Paris, and it will no doubt take much longer than that for Parisians to come to terms with what happened. The World's Leo Hornack was reporting for us from Paris last week. He's now back in London. But before he left Paris, he met with someone who knows more than most about coming to terms with grim reality. Jean-Christophe Bisselard is one of the chaplains on call for five different public hospitals in Paris. And as Leo found out, Bisselard was on call on the night of November 13th.
On Friday, when the tragedy began in Paris, he got a call saying, everyone to the hospitals who's on call, whether you're a doctor, whether you're the chaplain, whether you're whatever your role is, we need you here.
Wow. So he must have been, I would imagine, really busy that night. What did he see? What did he hear?
Well, one of the things that I discovered from him is that, in fact, he was also in New York as a priest at the time of 9/11. So it was very interesting speaking to him about the comparison between the kind of trauma that he saw on Friday in Paris and what he remembered from New York's experience. One of the practical differences, and very tragic differences really, is that in New York there were very few injured relative to the number of dead. Mm. In Paris, there were large numbers of injured amongst the casualties. And so that meant huge pressure on the hospitals to treat people. Here's what he told me.
They were war victims. I mean, it was war injuries. I mean, there is one lady that I remember, and honestly, I can't tell you the reason why I remember her more than other people. She came in the ER, she went straight to the, you know, to the welcoming desk, and she said, I've heard that my son was actually brought in this hospital. She was actually leaning both hands, you know, on the table, as if, you know, she was kind of afraid to collapse, you know, if the news was bad. What really struck me a lot was, I guess, you know, the anxiety, the fear as well, is quite distressing, to say the least.
For this chaplain, how's he seeing things now that some of the burials have begun for the dead in the Paris attacks? not to mention some of the people getting discharged from hospitals after their injuries.
I spoke to him just an hour ago to get an update, if you like, and he said, you know, now the burials are beginning, that does provide a sense of closure to some people, of course. I attended the minute silence, the 1 minute of silence that Paris had a week ago, and I caught up with some of the people I'd actually met there and had a quick chat with them just today. And I spoke to one woman who's a young French journalist, and she said that actually she got up today and she walked down through one of the big boulevards of Paris, and she said it was the first day when she felt like she could recognize the city again, and she could see the Eiffel Tower. She just sort of felt, ah, this is my city again. And she quoted to me the Latin phrase, which is the motto of Paris, which is fluctuat nec mergitur. Now, that means shaken or tossed like a boat, but not sunk. And a lot of people have been quoting that to me, and you see it even on billboards in Paris at the moment. So people are looking back at Paris's immense history and saying, we've been through troubles before, but we're still here.
The World's Leo Hornack back in London. Thank you very much for this, Leo.
Thank you, Marco.
And that's all from us today here at The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.